Tonight, our best of interviews on another beleaguered president, Richard Nixon, as President Trump faces multiple investigations. That's all tonight on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. We're joined now by John Farrell. He's a Nixon biographer.
I leave you, gentlemen, now, and you will now write it. You will interpret it. That's your right. But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
That, of course, was the California governor race, his apparent, or at the time, exit from politics. First off, why did he run for that job? He was never committed to it, right? And what do you take out of what he said?
Well, he never should have run for that because he never wanted to be governor of California. Right. His interests were always international affairs. And the idea of sitting in Sacramento planning highways and schools was just not where Richard Nixon was at. But the party prevailed upon him because they needed him, and he thought that might be a good perch by which to either challenge Kennedy in 64 or in 68. And for a variety of reasons, probably the most basic being that it was clear to the voters that he didn't want to be governor of California, he lost, and he called this what has come to be known as the last press conference because in addition to saying you're not going to have Nixon to kick around anymore, he also said, gentlemen, this is my last press conference. And, of course, it wasn't two more years before he was out on the campaign trail again, campaigning for Republican candidates. And within 6 years, he was in the president of the United States. So, again, one more amazing twist in the career of Richard Nixon.
Going into that wilderness period before he comes back out and wins in 68, Do you buy that there was a new Nixon, or was that just a marketing cereal box kind of thing?
Well, it was both. I think he was definitely getting older and more mature. The word that was used over and over again by even liberal authors like Hunter Thompson and Norman Mailer was that there was a mellow Nixon, and I'm not so sure that there really was a mellow Nixon, or if there was, the old Dick Nixon emerged within 6 or 9 months. Once he was in the crucible of the presidency.
Now, as we look at the foreign policy side, the Vietnamization, does that come to be rather cynically, just get a decent interval so we can get out of here, even though a lot of lives are going to be lost while we hang on to this?
He announced in the campaign that he was a peace candidate. Mm-hmm. And then he hinted that he had this great plan to end the war. And what the plan was to try to get the Soviet Union to pressure the North Vietnamese to reach some sort of agreement. And the way he was going to do that is that he was going to have a linkage with what the Soviets wanted in other parts of the world. And he never offered them, or they never really wanted anything that was worth having their foremost rival bogged down in this horrible war in Southeast Asia. And so that didn't work, and so they had to come up. They, meaning Nixon and his advisors, most notably Henry Kissinger, had to come up with alternate plans. And the best they had was a slow withdrawal by turning over the country to the Vietnamese, and it would be a race because there was they didn't have any confidence that the South Vietnamese would be able to handle their own defense against the much more motivated and hardy and equipped and experienced North. Before he felt he had to get out, which was by the 72 elections. So it was cynical in that regard. In order to get out, he had to go to both the Chinese and the Russians and say, look, we're not asking for a final deal. We're asking you to pressure North Vietnam to give us what became known as a decent interval where we can go home with our flags flying, win re-election, and pretend that anything happens after we left is just the South Vietnamese ineptitude, which pretty much is what we got. We didn't get much of an interval, and it certainly wasn't very decent.
It's very much unknown. I don't know if the word is liberal or not, but forming the EPA, the Clean Air Act, a health care proposal, a welfare proposal, OSHA. I didn't know he did Title IX, which is the big sports equality, desegregation. What do you think about the domestic side? And did he try to portray he didn't care?
What he wanted out of the domestic side was to do what the people wanted. And this was still an era of activist government where people expected government to fix stuff. They had you have to remember that his generation had used big government to defeat Hitler and Stalin. And they
build the interstate highway system and a whole bunch of other wonderful things. That so the government did not have the connotation that it had later on after Jimmy Carter and when Reagan came in and said government is the problem. Some of those things, he had a Democratic Congress, so a lot of those things were thrust upon him. Desegregation was thrust upon him by the United States Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And some things he had ulterior motives. He was a big and early proponent of affirmative action, but in part that was because it was a great way to split the Democratic Party's labor and minority bases. The environmental stuff was definitely self-initiated by Nixon. He was in office for more than a few weeks when they had the big Santa Barbara oil spill, which was one of the great first big environmental catastrophes. It really fueled the environmental movement that followed. And Nixon was quite content, very happy to sign all that legislation that the Democratic Congress sent him. On some things were cynical. The Title IX thing in particular, I always got a chuckle out of, because the tapes in the correspondence show that he was getting all these letters from Father Herzberg, who was the president of Notre Dame, or yep. Woody Hayes, the coach at Ohio State, saying, you can't do this. This is going to ruin our football programs. And yet Nixon went ahead and signed Title IX, and it's one of those accomplishments hanging there on the wall at the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda.
The road to Watergate, one of the things I find intriguing is he brings in these statesmen who wouldn't even have supported him. I'm talking Kissinger, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. They weren't necessarily even conservative, particularly Moynihan. And the other side, you've got H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, the sort of Prussian guards, Charles Colson. Is this the dichotomy of Nixon, these statesmen side by side by the dark side?
He had an interesting way of handling personnel. He wanted his administrative side of his presidency structured very rigidly. And so that's why he had Haldeman act in a certain way. Moynihan, who was much more free form, was sort of pushed aside, and Ehrlichman came in to take over domestic affairs. But never to the point that he denied brilliance. I mean, he saw brilliance in somebody like Moynihan or Kissinger.
Mm-hmm.
He was very good at bringing it in. Elliot Richardson, George Shultz. There's one footnote in the book that goes, it's about 2 inches long, and it's just the names of great American office holders who got their feet wet during the Nixon administration.
It is an amazing list, yeah.
Yeah, it is. Including one president, George Herbert Warren Bush. So, like many things about Nixon, it's tempting to say, one thing, the Berlin Wall, but then you have to sort of say, and yet. When I talk to an audience, I'm always saying that those are the two key words that you have to keep in mind with Richard Nixon, is that as soon as you say one thing, there's always going to be a but or an and yet, and something else on the other side. He's a very, very deft politician, until it came to that great crisis where it was us versus them, and he completely fell apart.
I got the sense that you put a fair amount of blame on Haldeman for the culture that he sort of let Nixon be Nixon too much, that he used Colson to sort of go sit with Nixon so he wouldn't have to spend hours, and Colson just did nothing but suck the devil out of him.
Haldeman occasionally, or maybe even often, would just ignore Nixon's crazier orders. And Nixon had actually put this in a memo. He'd actually sent it to his top staff, saying, look, there's going to be times when I say things that you're allowed to, not obey me. As long as you come back within 24 or 48 hours and say, that thing you told us the other day, boss, we didn't think that was a great idea, and here's why we didn't do it. So this was sort of built into the Nixon White House, but it was a heck of a way to run a railroad. When you get somebody like Charles Colson was brought in, who wasn't a longtime Nixon aide, who didn't have good judgment, and who saw that this skullduggery was one way that he could, as one of the Watergate prosecutors put it, he was the cat who could bring the dead mouse and put it at the master's door. He's the one who brought in Howard Hunt and led them down the road to the creation of the plumbers and eventually to Watergate. Interestingly enough, J. Edgar Hoover, who was the head of the FBI and had done all these dirty tricks for previous presidents, he saw that the times were changing and that he was very much afraid the FBI would be caught in some kind of scandal just like Watergate, and that's why he wouldn't let his agents indulge in the kind of behavior that they had done, bugging and burglaring for other presidents. And so Nixon's great initiative and his great downfall was that he brought the Dirty Tricks boys inside the White House. And so when they were caught, the trail led directly to the Oval Office. He knew everything. He was constantly on Haldeman and Ehrlichman. The one thing that happened in the course of me writing this book was that the final tranches of tapes came out. We now had, I think, 3,000 of the 3,700 hours of tapes. They were at my disposal. Some excellent scholars have created books and websites where you go online, you can listen to them yourself. The greatest hits are on YouTube. But it clearly shows that Nixon was constantly talking about his men committing perjury, finding hush money to pay off the burglars throughout that whole summer and fall of 1972.
Coming next, we'll talk with a foremost Nixon tapes expert. We're joined now by John Farrell. He's a Nixon biographer. The final days, Jack, was he mentally ill? Was he breakdown, drinking? Describe the end.
I think, if you say that the final days, starting maybe the fall of 1973, he was in a series of crises. If you remember, Vice President Spiro Agnew had to resign.
Yeah.
It had the summer of Watergate. There was war in the Middle East. There was further problems with the Soviet Union. And so Nixon was under a tremendous amount of pressure, and he was drinking heavily. It's somewhat exaggerated, I think, to say that he was, you know, smashed all the time or that he couldn't perform the duties of his office. But even some of his most fervent defenders within the diplomatic community and on his staff said, yeah, this was a problem that they had to work around in 73 and 74. And of course, by the time of the summer of 74 came along, he was under just tremendous stress and almost died from attack of phlebitis and depression when he went into exile in San Clemente after resigning the presidency.
All right, and as we leave the presidency,
always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself.
That quote has always blown me away because it's like the only time that Nixon has ever been sort of introspective and insightful, right?
Right, and it's at the very end, and all of a sudden there's this amazing moment of self-recognition.
Yes.
And it's so sad. And you know, one more time, the marvels of the Internet is that anybody who's listening, you can watch him say that. And I challenge you to watch him on YouTube and not feel a sense that this was one of the truly great tragic moments in American history.
It's just an amazing moment. And he wore glasses, which he never wore to read, and the whole thing. It was now in exile. Did he get this drive for resurrection, wallow in self-pity? How did he turn it around? Or what was his drive?
I think he turned it around by writing books. He made money doing that. He had some very rich friends who still protected him after he left the presidency. I think the David Frost interviews were a masterful stroke on both Frost and Nixon's part. They mm-hmm. were really gripping drama. But his efforts to, like, worm his way back into diplomatic circles were capped, I think, by the fact that he was so politically toxic. At his funeral, Bob Dole gave the eulogy and broke down crying.
Yeah, because, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah. Among other things, Nixon was the one politician who always remembered to extend his left hand to shake hands with Bob Dole, because Bob Dole had been wounded right. and lost the use of his right hand. But Bob Dole had this wonderful joke. Same guy, Bob Dole, who looked at the funeral, seeing Gerry Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Nixon going off to Anwar Sadat's funeral, said, there they are, hear no evil, see no evil, and evil.
You know, Jack, that just reminded me, talking about funerals, you know, Nixon controlled his emotions all his life, but I remember at Pat Nixon's funeral, who everybody thought he sort of almost abused, that he almost looked like he was collapsing.
Yes, the agony on his face
yes.
At a funeral, it's hard to take. There's a picture in the book taken that
yes.
day, and it's hard for me to look at.
Did he receive? He got Ford, Carter, Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Clinton succeeding. Did he respect them? Did he respect any of them? Did he think they were in his league?
No, definitely not. I think that he respected certain gifts that each of them
might have had. Interesting that you say that, because I always feel that, you know, 100 years from now, people are going to look back at the Cold War president, and they're going to judge him as a group. And I think they're going to give him pretty high marks for having navigated this very dangerous period where there were 40,000 nuclear weapons on the earth pointed at, you know, these two or three, four countries. And we managed to skate our way through it. And so I think they will get good marks. And I think he will be always sitting there with Truman and Eisenhower and JFK and Johnson and Jimmy Carter and Gerry Ford and finally Reagan. They'll all be seen as stewards in a very difficult time. And I think that their violations of civil liberties and the brush wars that they got us into, the proxy wars, will be taken into account. You know, one of the things that I've noticed just in doing the book and going around and talking to young audiences is how much Vietnam has receded and is now being put up on the shelf there next to the Korean War as you know, something that happened a long time ago, that there was a modest loss of life, but not the big searing event that it was to those of us who lived through it, right?
As we finish up on the legacy side, you know, they talk about blessed are the peacemakers. Do you think will he get a peacemaker credit? Do you see him ranking anywhere high?
Well, it's amazing. He's in the mid-20s, which, you know, you would think he'd be down there with James Buchanan at the bottom. But yeah. I think because of the domestic legislation that he signed, I think because especially the vision of taking advantage of the split between the Russians and the Chinese and opening China was a masterful stroke. Others might have done it, but he's the one who did it. So I think he'll always be the president who resigned. I think he'll always be a fascination to young people as the guy who's the cartoon on The Simpsons, the caricature of the bad guy. And yet, because of China and because of some of the other domestic things that he did on EPA and others.
Did you come away with a fundamental insight or something you didn't know about Nixon?
I did. One of the things that puzzled me immediately was that everybody who knew him and was still around and talked about him, they were very protective of him, almost as you would be with a wounded cousin or younger brother that you felt that you had to explain to people that, you know, Dick was a good guy, but he had these personality flaws and that manifested itself in horrible ways. But, you know, in heart, he had a horrible upbringing, and it was insecurities from that childhood that left him wounded the way he was. And I found a lot of that to be true.
Did you? Is it kind of tragic that you have this image of him as a kid, of being a dreamer, watching the trains go by, his house in Yorba Linda, into such a hard and ruthless and cynical guy?
Yeah, that's the original title of the book was An American Tragedy, because I thought that this was just a classic Horatio Alger story of this young kid escaping poverty, escaping a brutal household, almost like, you know, Oliver Twist or David Copperfield, and clawing his way up the walls of life, as one of his aides was later to put it, reaching the pinnacle of the presidency, going to China, coming home, assuring decades of world peace, and then being succumbing to this fatal flaw, this insecurity, this feeling of burning resentment, and then losing it all. And so it's like something you'd see on a Greek stage or in a Shakespearean theater.
In just a couple of seconds, is he ultimately an elusive character?
No, I found him. I found him actually, you know, much simpler and less complex than I expected.
Interesting. Oh, it's been a fast hour. Thanks to John Farrell. The book is Richard Nixon, The Life, a fascinating book. Coming next, we'll talk with the foremost Nixon tapes expert. Joining us now, he's an assistant professor at Texas A&M University.
We're talking with Luke Nichter. He is acknowledged, even at his young age, as the foremost expert on the Nixon tapes. From the foremost authority in the nation on the Nixon tapes, we dive deep inside the Watergate scandal, Nixon taping himself covering up Watergate. Today on Business Talk with Jim Campbell, Luke Nichter is an associate professor of history at Texas A&M University, Central Texas, and his latest work, The Nixon Tapes, 1973, co-edited and annotated with one of the top historians in the nation, Douglas Brinkley. This is volume two in their books on the Nixon White House tapes, 3,700 hours of Nixon taping himself in an epic Greek tragedy, ending up with his self-destruction, and we're glad to have him back for his second time. How are you, Luke?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on again.
Another monster, 819 pages, but serving history, and of course you can't put it down. And let's get the basics out of the way first. Have you actually listened to all of those tapes and the transcripts that are in the book? How do you work with Brinkley, and do you end up paranoid like Nixon after listening to all this?
Well, lots of loaded questions there, I think. Well, absolutely. Everything that's in the book, I have listened to myself and transcribed. People sometimes ask me, have you listened to every single tape? And it's hard to know because, you know, you don't go through listening comprehensively. You're looking for Vietnam or you're looking for China or some kind of subject. I like to say if I haven't listened to all of them, then it's pretty close to all of them, and I couldn't tell you which ones I haven't listened to. And working with Doug on this has been so great because Doug is just such, one of America's greatest storytellers. And putting us together, it turned out it was a great partnership. Our families knew each other 40 years ago in a little town in Ohio. So it was a good partnership, and what Doug was able to do is kind of take the details of the Nixon tapes and kind of make it into a story that would appeal very broadly to a big part of the population. So, this is still, even with these two big books, just a percentage of the tapes. There are 700 hours of tapes yet to be released. These books each started 1,600 pages, single-spaced, in rough draft form.
Wow.
So at a certain point in the future, I'll just put all the rest of the stuff online on the website, nixontapes.org.
You talk about a growing paranoia that you can actually hear on the tapes. Did you have a sense that Nixon was literally losing his sanity by the end? And what about the fact Orr saying, well, this is somewhat business as usual at JFK and LBJ stuff, too, and they even taped themselves?
This book, focusing on the year 1973, is really, Nixon on the way down. The difference, though, as readers, is we know what's coming. We know what's ahead for Nixon, his resignation, the articles of impeachment in the House of Representatives. And as we're reading and seeing this story unfolding, the primary characters in that story don't know that. So it kind of take yourself back. It's like a time machine in a way, and kind of pretend like you don't know what's coming. But you do see Nixon, whether it's paranoia or things are starting to unravel. He suggests to Al Haig that maybe I should just quit, step aside, and retire and get out of the way. He says, I'm not at my best. And I was talking to Chris Matthews about this of Hardball, and he said, not someone who's typically sympathetic of Richard Nixon. And he said, you just read this, and you just have a feeling for Nixon, like this guy's just getting nibbled to death, and you feel a little bad. He's getting nibbled to death every day by the press, and things are unraveling. And even Chris Matthews said, you feel a little remorse and sympathy for what he must have been going through in this volume.
One of the things you talk about as a fatal flaw was just an incredible distrust of all of his aides. What I find interesting to that is John Dean, who he has almost zero exposure to until this thing blows up, maybe he trusted him too much.
It's a complicated issue, his relationship with John Dean. John Dean is counsel to the president, 31 years old. I mean, imagine this, the president having a 31-year-old attorney, and up to this point working primarily on presidential appointments, vetting the credentials of people who might be appointed to various positions, the Nixon's estate and will and those types of things. In this case, becomes, in Dean's own words, the chief desk officer for Watergate. So it's this amazing transformation that happens to his duties. And you take someone who is not in the Nixon inner circle and by the nature of Watergate is thrust right to the epicenter of that circle almost overnight. And he's someone who in the first volume spends no time with Richard Nixon at all. In this volume, spending very long meetings and phone calls with Nixon, dealing with all the intricacies of Watergate. So it's whether he trusted Dean too much, or I think whether he tried to set Dean up to be the possible scapegoat for Watergate. It is true that the personalities of the Nixon administration and the roles that they each played are ultimately the story of the unraveling.
Okay, borrowing from Howard Baker, what did the president know and when did he know it? The tapes are clear on this, but let's get it from you as well. Did he know anything about the Watergate burglary, and what was he covering up?
I am always one to say there are many records yet to be released, 700 hours of tapes, many, many records of the Nixon White House, many records of the intelligence agencies. You know, there are literally millions of pages of records that have not been released, even though it's been more than 40 years. Based on what we have available to us today, I can say with certainty Nixon did not know anything about the break-in in advance. There is some talk that he may have hatched this scheme down in Florida at his home in Key Biscayne or on Air Force One. Well, those are places that were not taped as part of the White House taping system, so I don't have records, so I can only answer on that basis. We do know that he knew about the cover-up. That was the problem. That's, you know, it's been this adage in Washington today to the present day that it's never, you know, it's the cover-up, it's the crime, and everybody forgets what the original crime was. And it was the cover-up that certainly did Nixon in. He had early knowledge of the cover-up. It didn't always direct it, although you see by March and April in this volume, he's very much kind of beginning to call the shots as his aides are starting to lawyer up, jump ship, leave the administration. That leaves who to run the cover-up? It leaves Richard Nixon. So you see Nixon's own role evolve with regard to the Watergate cover-up kind of right before our eyes in the book.
Do you have any sense as to why they were going into the Watergate?
Oh, this is one of the key questions. 40 years later, we still do not have definitive answers to why they broke in to the Democratic National Committee offices in the Watergate building in Washington, what they were looking for, why did the burglars all have backgrounds in the intelligence, CIA, FBI, and, you know, there are whole library shelves full of books that postulate why they were in there in the first place, which 40 years later, we do not have the hard evidence. When the Watergate trial of the burglars who broke in went to court, U.S. v. Liddy, and was heard before Judge John Sirica, who would eventually become quite a household name during that era, this was the question he asked himself. While we've got all these guys here, these witnesses and these burglars, let's figure out why they did this crazy thing to begin with. And as he started to call witnesses in to get testimony, hopefully to help answer that question, those are among the records that are still sealed today, including the government star witness, Al Baldwin, from New Haven, Connecticut, by the way, who was the listener on the wiretaps at the Howard Johnson Motel right across the street from the Watergate.
Interesting.
His testimony today he's the star witness, called by the government, yet it was the government who sealed his testimony. So we don't know exactly, and it's why I look and say, as a historian, I hope all these records are out one day. I think we deserve to know, as stakeholders in our democracy, as taxpayers who paid for this very costly period of time in our history, and as citizens who have ultimately paid the price in our democracy for this time and period of history. All the records should come out, but we have to again repeat that there are many, many records that are not out about this time period, and I certainly hope in the future that's the kind of question I can answer a lot better.
As I told you the last time you were on, that Holiday Inn or Howard Johnson is now a dorm for GW, George Washington University, and I've been in it because my daughter went there, and I've been in seen the exact room where they were bugging. We're down to about a minute and a half. One of the things that really hit me in this segment is that how incompetent all this stuff was. Even Nixon continually can't fathom whether it's sitting in the Attorney General's office designing a ridiculous plan of kidnappings, prostitutes, the break-in at Watergate, the break-in at Ellsberg, Donald Segretti. It's almost Keystone Cops.
These kinds of subjects should never be discussed in the presence of the Attorney General. And I think that all goes without saying. But I think there's a deeper meaning to what he said. And it's all deniability. Campaign kind of hijinks go on, I think, in all campaigns. Probably we can agree that what was being proposed in the Nixon 72 campaign, as it was suggested, although I'm not aware of things like mugging teams and burglaries like that were ever actually implemented, those certainly went further than typical campaign hijinks. There's just an amazing array of things that go on. And going back to your Howard Baker question, we still don't know, how much Nixon was aware of all that. It's clear to me on the tapes that even if Nixon wasn't aware of all this, I still wouldn't give him a pass and say, well, he didn't know about that. Nixon endorsed a certain climate of activity in the Nixon White House. And I think it was only because of that climate that even the suggestion of these kinds of activities, I think, was acceptable to discuss in the presence of the Attorney General.
That's a good way to end this segment of Cancer Growing Within the Presidency next. We're talking with Lou Nichter. He is acknowledged, even at his young age, as the foremost expert on the Nixon tapes. Final national segment coming right up.
Hi, this is Robert Reese on the CEO Show, and we're here today with Kate Gutman from UPS, and you have three roles, which we said already.
That's right.
Which is, you know,
Chief Sales and Solutions Officer, the Senior Vice President over the UPS store, and UPS Capital, a transportation insurance business.
So here you are in a company of 434,000 people, and you're I think, one of the two top women senior executives
yes.
here.
Mm-hmm.
You started in 1989 as an intern. How did you build your way all the way up?
Well, I'll tell you, by working with some amazing people. That is the short answer. I was fortunate in that when I was in college at Siena College in upstate New York, they had an internship program with UPS. And I started and then fell in love with the culture of the company and the focus on the customer. And I haven't looked back. So I would tell you what has helped me is saying yes to opportunity. I was a small town girl and had opportunities to move away from my family, which was the hardest thing. But I said yes to opportunity, have lived now globally and moved seven times. So it takes giving a lot, but also getting a lot and a lot of hard work and determination.
And you and I have spoken in the past, and one of the things that you're really passionate about is if there's a problem and you could write it down, you could solve it. And even though you're listening on radio, Kate is nodding,
right?
Absolutely. Talk about that and what people could learn from the ability to just solve problems.
It is so important. If you can really, as someone is talking to you about the problem and you can identify it and say to them, well, what do you think we should do about it? And then pause and listen, because a lot of the time the front line will have the answer that is much better than maybe someone that's a few steps away from it. But always pushing people to use their creative solutioning on how do you solve it. You know, one thing we phrase here is shifting to yes and how. So yes and how, even though you might have
shift
said,
from a question, you go to yes and how.
Right. So
I
if
like
you had
that.
To do it, how would you do it? So then that gets them off of anybody off of the mindset of here's the problem, and then it grows in size because you put a lot of energy into it. I will tell you also, we talked about any advice for people coming up in their careers, and you should use it also on your personal life. You shouldn't fuel the problem. The more you think about a problem and relive it and tell people about the problem, you're wasting the energy that should be going into the solution. And you're also fostering maybe some of that negative energy when it should be fueled more to the positive. So I've used that as a rule in life for both business and professional.
How do you do that in an age when you see challenges coming up, ankle biters like Uber moving into your business, and then Amazon and, you know, Google, they're coming down at you in a world where there are constant challenges? How do you stay focused on solutions and not dwell on the problems?
You've got to keep your eyes wide open, of course. You can't be naive about any of it. You always have to think about mutually beneficial solutions, because then you can explain to the other party why it's beneficial to them, but also that you're in this business to make money as well. And so it is also taking it one bite at a time. Keeping your eye on the future while you've solved today, and solving, again, is that key word. So understanding, dissecting, but getting quickly to the how, yes and how again. How do you move forward on that down the path so that you can land in a better spot 3 to 5 years out?
So I'd like to now ask about advice to women specifically. As you know, one of my personal goals is we only have 24 Fortune 500 women CEOs, more named John, actually, than women, and I've set the goal we need to have 50, which is not enough. That's only 10%, but at least we have critical mass then. You grew up with two working parents,
yes.
And you were driven for that. What did you learn about being a woman in business, and what advice do you have for women on how they can succeed?
Well, first of all, I'll say, Robert, you've always impressed me with your passion for women in business. And I've met your daughter, and she is also, I understand your passion now. But that's how my parents were. It was not a, Kate, there's a glass ceiling there. Look at the problem and try to break through the problem. It's go shape your future. You know, put your energy into whatever you think you can do, and the sky's the limit. And so that's an important thing. It's not listening to the conditioning of society, but rather to your inner voice and what you can achieve. And then just channeling your energy on making that a reality instead of, again, focusing sometimes on the bad days or the bad meetings. Again, I walk past it. I think to myself, okay, containerize that. That didn't go great. What would we do differently? Move on. And don't stew on any one particular interaction. So I would say that is key, especially a lot of this generation's women, like myself, but especially this next generation grew up with both working parents, and to see more and more role models that were women working, and then such as a UPS, seeing multiple women at the top of this organization helps everybody understand that there's opportunity for everyone, male or female, and of all diversity. So it's proven statistically that more diversity equals better results. So why wouldn't we want to do that?
And on that inspirational note, what have you learned about building a culture at your years at UPS?
So I will say our founder, Jim Casey, was so visionary that what he said 111 years ago applies to our transformation now. So we're blessed to have that as part of our history. But the culture is one of partnership. When a UPSer does leave, what I hear from them is, I can find many great companies, I can't find the same people. And when they say that, they mean the people and the principles and culture that comes along with it. So establishing, I would say, line of sight and really the values, the core values of the company, practicing them, not just saying them. That's the critical must-do, especially in this day and age. You have to live up to what you say. And then separately, I would say, be cautious or ensure your traditions don't commingle with your culture. So I'll give you one easy
example.
That's
a great sentence.
Well, thank you. Sometimes people say, oh, we're giving up the culture. No, that was just a tradition that happened even 20 years ago,
right,
but not 111 years ago. And so you have to keep people focused on the culture that makes the company so strong and not get distracted by some of the things that happen when markets change over time.
Did you want to give any more specific example? Did I cut you off right there?
No, not at all.
No, okay,
that's
we're good.
Fine. Yeah,
because I have an important question, which is the future of UPS. What do you see this great company, and where do you see it going?
So I would tell you the 95% of consumers are outside the U.S., and we're already established in over 220 countries and territories worldwide. We want to continue to help the U.S. market thrive and are determined to do that. We want to help small and medium-sized businesses be able to compete in a world where there's customers in countries they've never been to. But it feels so easy, it doesn't matter. And so that's our goal, we are investing to ensure we help these small and medium-sized businesses compete and get their fair share of the market.
A pleasure having you on the CEO Show.
Thank you so much, Robert. I appreciate it.